imagine a multi-million dollar corporation, right?
Yeah.
And they are backed by this massive, high-powered law firm.
Oh, sure.
But they are completely paralyzed by a piece of paper worth exactly $237.
Wait, 237? That's it?
That is it. I mean, they
Whoa.
want to pay it. They are literally begging to pay it. But the person they owe flat out refuses to take the money.
Oh, wow. Which is actually kind of brilliant.
Right.
Yeah.
And by refusing that tiny check, this person effectively holds the entire legal record of the corporation hostage.
Yeah, they are forcing them to spend, you know, thousands of dollars in attorney's fees just to ask a judge for permission to hand over the cash.
Exactly. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we were looking at a story that, well, completely dismantles that classic sitcom trope of the quirky neighborhood dispute.
Oh, yeah, this isn't a fight over a loud dog or like a neon mailbox.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
We are stepping into the actual architecture of modern homeowners associations. And, you know, these HOAs function essentially as privatized local governments.
They really do, but they totally lack the constitutional separation of powers that keep actual governments in check.
Which is exactly why these disputes so frequently go nuclear.
Right, precisely. I mean, when you have an environment where the governing documents are enforced through formal legal ultimatums instead of like neighborly conversations, the original dispute often just becomes secondary.
Yeah, it just spirals.
It does. You are no longer fighting about a tree branch or a financial ledger. You are engaging in this highly sophisticated multi-year war of attrition.
And it's measured entirely in civil filings and procedural traps.
Exactly.
So today, for you listening, our mission is to reconstruct one of those wars. We are looking at a case called William M. Brown against Terra Vita Country Club.
And what makes this deep dive so unique is our stack of sources.
Yes, the sources are amazing. We aren't looking at news clippings, right?
Yeah.
Or someone's summarized opinion of what happened.
No, we are looking entirely at primary source legal documents pulled straight from the Maricopa County Superior Court in Arizona.
It's all right there. We have verified complaints, legal motions, minute entries from the judge. We even have internal email chains between the parties.
And the actual affidavits from the process servers, which is my favorite part. Reading primary legal documents like this, it provides a completely unvarnished view of the machinery of civil litigation.
It really does. You literally see the timestamps on the email sent before dawn.
Right. You read the specific statutory mechanisms being deployed to force an opponent's hand. You even see the physical descriptions of the people being served with lawsuits in their own offices.
It's just this unfiltered look at how the judicial system processes extreme interpersonal friction.
Yeah.
So if you're wondering how a simple neighborhood disagreement escalates into demands for massive financial sanctions, that's what we're going to decode today.
Let's get into it.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the inciting incident. Because the root of this entire multi-jurisdictional siege is fundamentally just a battle over a stack of papers.
A literal stack of papers.
Right. So the timeline starts on July 29th, 2016. A man named William M. Brown makes a formal request to his HOA, the Terra Vita Country Club, for specific records of account.
And we really need to establish a critical piece of the puzzle right here at the start.
Okay, what is it?
Mr. Brown is acting pro se.
Oh, right. Meaning he is representing himself.
Exactly. He hasn't hired a firm to handle this. He is drafting the documents and navigating the procedural labyrinth completely on his own.
Which is wild. And the nature of his request is also super central to understanding the conflict, isn't it?
It is. Brown is asking for documents related to an earlier matter, a totally separate case involving the Terra Vita Country Club.
And he isn't just asking as a casual favor, right? Like, hey guys, can I see the books?
No, not at all. He is invoking a specific legal framework built into Arizona's planned community statutes. Specifically, it's ARS Section 33-1805, the Records Availability Law.
Right. And to understand why this mechanism even exists, you really have to look at the structural power dynamic of a mandatory membership community.
Yeah, because when you buy a house in a community like Terra Vita, you don't just get a deed to a property.
No, you don't. That deed compulsorily ties you to a corporate entity.
And that is the absolute foundation of the HOA model. It's a system of covenants, conditions, and restrictions, CC&Rs.
Right.
By purchasing the property, you agree to pay assessments, you agree to be bound by the board's rules, and you basically grant a board of directors the authority to make financial decisions on your behalf.
And because you are legally compelled to fund this private corporation, the state recognizes that you must have a mechanism to hold them accountable.
Exactly. That is what the state's sunshine laws are designed to do. They dictate that all financial and other records of the association must be made reasonably available for examination by any member.
I mean, the underlying logic is just transparency, right? If it's your money funding the community, you have a statutory right to look under the hood and see how those funds are being managed.
In theory, yes. But there is a massive psychological gap between the intent of a transparency law and the reality of HOA governance.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Because these boards are usually made up of volunteer homeowners.
Right.
Right. And they often feel that producing endless records for residents who, you know, scrutinize every single dime is incredibly burdensome.
Yeah, they feel like it distracts from the actual management of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just trying to get the pool cleaned. Leave me alone.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the homeowners feel an absolute entitlement to see the books because, well, they are the ones cutting the checks.
So that friction is just a powder keg.
It is arguably the single most common origin point for HOA litigation. A homeowner asks for documents, the board stalls, or maybe they claim the request is overly broad.
Or they just provide a partial ledger.
Yeah. And then the homeowner views this as a willful cover-up, while the board views the homeowner's persistence as just pure harassment.
And in this specific case, the filings allege that the Terra Vida Country Club failed to timely provide the records Brown requested.
They drag their feet.
Right. So barely 2 weeks after his initial request, on August 15th, 2016, Brown escalates the situation.
He doesn't wait around.
No. He files a formal Homeowners Association dispute process petition with the Arizona Department of Real Estate. He is formally alleging a violation of the state's planned community statutes.
Which brings us to the first mechanism of the administrative state here. The Arizona Department of Real Estate, the ADRE, operates an administrative tribunal specifically designed to handle these exact types of HOA conflicts.
Why do they have a separate tribunal for this?
It's all about judicial economy. The state does not want the superior courts, which are dealing with felonies, massive corporate lawsuits, complex family law cases.
Right.
They don't want those courts to be entirely clogged up with arguments over whether an HOA produced a bank statement fast enough.
That makes sense. So this administrative tribunal is supposed to be a streamlined, cost-effective way to resolve these specific statutory disputes.
Exactly. And the tribunal eventually acts. It takes a while. But nearly a year later, in July 2017, an administrative law judge issues a decision.
And it is a total victory for Mr. Brown. The judge, Velva Moses Thompson, deems him the prevailing party.
A clean sweep.
Yeah. And the very next day, the commissioner of the Department of Real Estate, Judy Lowe, issues a final order. And, I mean, the language is absolute.
Very absolute. The commissioner demands that the Terra Vida Country Club comply with the records request within 10 days.
The HOA even tries to request a rehearing, but the commissioner just denies it, explicitly stating that the order is a final administrative action and is effective immediately.
So the administrative process has run its full course. The state agency tasked with overseeing real estate has definitively spoken.
The appeal is denied.
Yep. The 10-day countdown has started.
Okay, wait. So if the state's Department of Real Estate issues a final, legally binding order, shouldn't that just be the end of the road?
You would think so.
I mean, if I get a speeding ticket and a judge orders me to pay a fine, I have to pay it. It's like a referee blowing a whistle on a football field.
Right. The play is dead.
Exactly. The penalty is assessed and the game moved on. If an administrative judge says hand over the documents, why are we about to talk about this case spilling over into a massive superior court lawsuit?
What's fascinating here is that an administrative judge is not a referee with the immediate physical power to move the ball back 10 yards.
What do you mean?
Well, this highlights a crucial distinction in civil law between declaratory power and coercive power.
Okay, lay that out for us.
When an administrative tribunal issues an order, they are essentially declaring the rights and obligations of the parties. They are saying, legally speaking, Mr. Brown is right and the HOA is wrong.
Okay.
But they lack the physical enforcement mechanism, the coercive power, to compel action if the losing party simply digs their heels in.
Oh, wow. So the piece of paper says, you must do this. But if the HOA crosses its arms and says, make me, the administrative judge doesn't have, like, a squad of sheriffs waiting to kick down the doors of the country club.
Exactly. They can't seize the filing cabinets and hand the folders to the homeowner.
That is wild.
When a party defies a final administrative order, the administrative agency basically hits a brick wall. the winning party cannot rely on the agency to enforce the ruling.
What do they do?
They have to take that final order and pivot to a completely different branch of the judicial system. They need a court that actually does possess the power of contempt, the power of severe financial sanction, and the authority to deploy law enforcement if necessary.
And in Arizona, that authority resides in the Superior Court.
Exactly.
Which forces Mr. Brown to file an entirely new lawsuit just to enforce the victory he already won. I mean, the friction of the system requires him to start a new legal battle to validate the previous one.
And this transition from an administrative hearing to the Maricopa County Superior Court fundamentally alters the stakes of the conflict.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, the Superior Court is an arena of high-stakes adversarial litigation. It has incredibly strict procedural rules. The gloves essentially come off.
And Brown clearly recognizes this.
Oh, yeah.
Because his next move is what I can only describe as the nuclear option.
It really is.
On September 5, 2017, he files a verified complaint and application for an order to show cause in the Superior Court. Let's break down that mechanism real quick. He is basically asking a Superior Court judge to force the defendants to physically stand in a courtroom and explain, to show cause, why they shouldn't be held in contempt of court for ignoring the state's order.
Right. But the really fascinating part isn't the mechanism itself, is it?
No. Is who he points that mechanism at.
The list of defendants in this complaint is an absolute masterclass in aggressive legal strategy. He does not simply name the corporate entity Taravita Country Club, Inc.
No. He goes directly after the human beings running the corporation. He names the president of the board, Lavig, the vice president, Tolk, the secretary, Greg, and the treasurer, Ellington, individually.
But he goes one massive step further, because Arizona is a community property state.
This is crazy.
Yeah. Brown officially names all of their spouses as co-defendants in the lawsuit.
We have to unpack the mechanics of community property to understand why this is such a devastating tactic.
We do. In a community property state, any debt or liability incurred by one spouse during a marriage is generally considered an obligation of the community, meaning both spouses. If you sue a board member individually and win a financial judgment against them, but you didn't name their spouse in the lawsuit, you might be legally barred from collecting that judgment against their shared assets.
Like their joint bank accounts or their shared home.
Exactly.
So naming the spouse isn't just a formality. It's the only way to ensure you can actually collect the money if you win.
From a purely legal standpoint, yes, it is a necessary step to access the marital assets. But from a psychological and tactical standpoint, it creates an unbearable amount of leverage.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Think about the reality of an HOA board. These are volunteer positions. People run for the board to decide on, like, landscaping contracts or pool hours.
Right, they just want to pick the color of the clubhouse.
Exactly. And suddenly, because of a dispute over a ledger, a process server shows up at their house and hands a lawsuit to their husband or wife.
The spouse is now officially a named defendant in a Superior Court action. Their shared financial security is actively threatened. Their personal assets are in the crosshairs.
The internal domestic pressure that places on a board member to simply surrender and hand over the documents is immense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine that conversation at the dinner table.
Honey, why are we being sued for $10,000 over an HOA ledger?
Yeah, just give him the books, Gary.
Exactly. But Brown doesn't even stop with the spouses. The most aggressive maneuver in this entire complaint is that he sues the HOA's outside legal counsel.
He names the entire law firm representing the country club. Carpenter, Hazelwood, Delgado & Bolin, PLC. And he specifically names the two individual attorneys working the case, Joshua Bolin and Anjali Patel, as defendants.
Suing opposing counsel is a legal maneuver that instantly triggers the highest level of scrutiny from a judge.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It strikes at the very foundation of the adversarial system.
Well, let's talk about the financial demand before we get into the theory of suing lawyers, because the money kind of explains the strategy here. In his prayer for relief, Brown demands that the court find all of these defendants, the HOA entity, the four board members, their four spouses, the law firm, and the two individual attorneys, in willful contempt.
And he asks the judge to impose a financial sanction of $10,000 per defendant.
If you calculate the distinct defendants listed, he is asking the judge to drop a $110,000 hammer on them.
And to justify a number that large, he actually attaches the Taravita Country Club's IRS tax returns to the complaint.
Yeah, he points out to the judge that the corporation had total revenues in 2015 of over $3.7 million.
The logic he is presenting is essentially, Your Honor, this is a multi-million dollar corporation. If you fine them $500, they will just laugh, pay it out of petty cash, and continue hiding the records.
Right. You have to hit them with a sanction so massive that it physically deters their notorious defiance and punishes their disrespect for the rule of law.
The legal concept he is relying on here is the difference between compensatory damages and punitive or coercive sanctions.
Walk us through that difference.
Sure. He isn't claiming that he personally lost $110,000 because he didn't get the records. He is asking the court to use its power to coerce compliance.
Oh, I see.
He is arguing that a multi-million dollar entity views minor fines as simply the cost of doing business. A six-figure sanction is designed to change their fundamental calculus.
Okay, to make this real, let's look at the process server details included in the primary sources, because this paints quite a picture.
It really does.
These are the sworn statements proving that the legal documents were physically delivered. On October 6, 2017, at exactly 11:10 a.m., a process server named Bert Young walks into the law offices of the firm representing the HOA in Tempe, Arizona.
He navigates to Suite 400.
Right. And he serves these papers directly to Joshua Bolin, the opposing attorney.
And the record even includes a physical description taken by the server.
Yeah. An approximately 53-year-old Caucasian male, 5'11", 195 pounds.
Just picture the reality of that moment. You are an attorney. You are sitting at your desk managing dozens of active cases for various clients. A process server walks into your personal workspace and hands you a summons where you are the named defendant. And you're being sued for $10,000 by the exact same person you are currently fighting in court on behalf of your client.
If I'm looking at this as an outsider, my immediate thought is, isn't suing the opposing lawyer just asking the judge to throw the book at you?
It's extremely risky.
I mean, where is the line between zealous self-representation and legally frivolous harassment? How can you sue a lawyer for simply doing their job?
Well, if you can sue the opposing counsel every time you disagree with their client, the whole system collapses, right?
Exactly.
That is precisely the argument the attorneys make in their defense, and it hinges on the legal concept of duty.
Tell me about duty.
When an attorney takes on a case, they owe a strict fiduciary duty, a duty of loyalty, and a duty of competence to their client. In this scenario, the client is the Terra Vita Country Club. The attorney's job is to fiercely advocate for the HOA's interests, to protect their legal standing, and to advise them on strategy. An attorney fundamentally does not owe a legal duty to the opposing party.
So the lawyer's defense is basically, I don't work for you, Mr. Brown. My obligation is to my client. I am not the one withholding the records. I am simply the legal shield for the corporation, that is.
Exactly. Bolin and Patel file a motion to dismiss, and they address this head on. They argue that the complaint fails to articulate any valid legal claim against them as individuals.
Because they don't hold the records.
Right. They point out that the final administrative order from the Department of Real Estate, you know, the order Brown is trying to enforce, only legally binds Brown and the association.
It does not bind the association's outside legal counsel.
Exactly. The lawyers assert to the judge that they were only named in this lawsuit as a form of harassment.
Yeah, they are arguing that Brown is weaponizing the judicial system. He's using the threat of personal financial ruin to intimidate the HOA's lawyers into abandoning their client.
And they ask the court to dismiss the claims with prejudice.
Meaning they can't be brought back from the dead.
Right. And they demand that Brown pay the costs they incurred defending themselves against these frivolous claims.
Wow. And judges are incredibly protective of an attorney's ability to advocate for their clients, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. If the precedent was set that a litigant could routinely sue the opposing lawyers, it would create an immediate, paralyzing conflict of interest.
Because the attorney would constantly be weighing their client's best interests against their own personal risk of being sued.
Precisely. The adversary system relies on lawyers being able to fight aggressively without fear of personal retribution from the other side.
Okay, so we now have a situation where a homeowner is demanding six-figure sanctions, volunteer board members' spouses have their assets threatened, and lawyers are being ambushed by process servers in their own firms.
The tension is just incredible.
You might assume that with the temperature this high, the day-to-day communication between the parties would be incredibly formal, maybe even handled solely through the judge.
You'd think so, but no.
Civil litigation requires constant interaction. And that brings us to the internal emails from early November 2017.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, these emails offer a fascinating window into the psychological warfare of procedure.
Let's set the scene. The HOA's lawyers have filed their motions to dismiss, trying to get themselves and the board members extracted from the lawsuit.
Right.
Under the rules of civil procedure, Mr. Brown has a strict deadline to file a written response defending his strategy.
And remember, he's doing this all pro se.
Yes. On November 6th at 5:39 in the morning, Brown sends an email to the opposing attorney, Joshua Bolin.
The timestamp alone tells a story.
5:39 a.m.
This is a pro se litigant awake before dawn, working on his case before his regular day even begins.
While a law firm has paralegals, junior associates, and automated docketing software, a pro se litigant has their kitchen table and their own free time.
The disparity in resources is immense.
But despite the hostility of the lawsuit, Brown's email is remarkably professional. He politely asks defense counsel for an extension of time to file his response.
And his logic is actually quite sound.
Right. He explains that there are other supplemental pleadings currently sitting on the judge's desk, and depending on how the judge rules on those pleadings, the entire issue of dismissing the lawyers might become moot.
So Brown suggests they stipulate or mutually agree to push back the deadline.
He argues that forcing the paperwork right now would ill serve the parties, waste the court's time, and simply increase the cost of litigation.
He's asking for what is known in the legal profession as a professional courtesy.
Oh.
Attorneys routinely grant each other deadline extensions for exactly these types of logistical reasons. It is a standard practice built on mutual professional respect and the understanding that eventually every lawyer will need a similar favor.
But Bolin does not extend that courtesy. At 8:13 a.m. that same morning, Bolin replies directly from his mobile phone.
Swift and decisive.
Very. The response is brief and icy. Mr. Brown, at this point, we cannot agree to a second extension without just cause. The motions to dismiss are separate issues from the records request. We need to keep this matter moving forward.
And he ends it with the classic mobile signature.
Oh, yeah. I apologize for any typos.
This exchange perfectly encapsulates the brutal reality of representing yourself in court. The legal system allows you to act pro se, but it does not grade you on a curve.
You are held to the exact same rigorous procedural standards, the same filing deadlines, and the same rules of evidence as an attorney with decades of experience.
The judge isn't going to give you a pass just because you didn't go to law school and don't know how to format a pleading.
Absolutely not. And when opposing counsel denies a routine extension, they're intentionally utilizing procedure as a weapon.
Bolin isn't just being stubborn. He is executing a calculated strategy.
Right. The defense has no obligation to make Brown's life easier.
By holding his feet to the fire on every single deadline, they are increasing the pressure, draining his time, and honestly, hoping he makes a critical procedural error that allows them to win the case on a technicality.
And because Bolin refused the informal agreement over email, this forces Brown to pivot. He has to draft, print, sign, and officially file a formal motion for extension of time directly with the judge.
Which adds yet another layer of paperwork to an already bulging file.
Right. He has to ask the judge to overrule Bolin's refusal. This requires the judge to read a motion, perhaps read an opposition from Bolin, and issue a ruling, all over a simple scheduling issue.
It is the deliberate generation of administrative friction, which is how civil litigation is often waged. It is one in the margins of procedure.
And speaking of administrative friction, if you thought suing the lawyers was the peak of this conflict, we need to introduce the subplot of the $237 check.
Oh, this is where it gets really incredible.
Here's where it gets really interesting, folks. This is where the legal maneuvering crosses over into pure absurdity.
It really does.
In October 2017, right in the middle of this massive lawsuit over records and sanctions, Brown files a motion to transfer a completely different case into this courtroom.
He asks that case number CV 2017-013317 be assigned to Judge John R. Hanna.
Right. Arguing that both cases involve the same parties and the same properties, and that combining them would serve judicial economy.
Judicial economy is the principle that a court should manage its docket efficiently. If two lawsuits involve the same people fighting over the same basic issues, it is a waste of taxpayer resources to have two different judges learning the same facts.
Consolidating them makes sense in theory.
It does. But this specific motion to transfer forces the HOA's lawyers to file an objection. And in doing so, they have to explain to Judge Hanna exactly what this other lawsuit is actually about.
And the backstory they reveal is just staggering. It introduces a new individual into the narrative, Anita Bell.
According to the filings, Anita Bell is a joint tenant and co-owner with William Brown of the property in Scottsdale.
And because she is on the deed, she is also a mandatory member of the Terra Vita Country Club.
The lawyers explain that in a previous, separate dispute, the HOA sued Anita Bell. They were seeking a legal injunction to force her and her guests to comply with the community's rules and regulations.
However, the HOA eventually decided to back down and voluntarily dismiss their own lawsuit against her.
Right. And when a plaintiff voluntarily drops a case, the court will often order them to reimburse the defendant for the basic administrative costs they incurred just for having to show up.
So the judge ordered the Terra Vita Country Club to pay Anita Bell her appearance fee. And the total amount of this court-ordered reimbursement was exactly $237.
For a corporation that generates nearly $4 million a year, a $237 fee is literally a rounding error. It is petty cash.
Right. You cut the check, mail it to the homeowner, file the receipt with the court, and close the file forever.
That is what a normal corporation would do.
And according to the filings, that is exactly what the Terra Vita Country Club tried to do. They made diligent efforts to tender the payment to Mrs. Bell. They sent her the money.
But she simply refused to accept it. She would not cash the check.
Wait, why would she do that?
To understand why refusing to cash a check is such a devastatingly effective tactical maneuver, we have to look at the life cycle of a civil judgment.
Okay, break that down.
When a court orders a party to pay money, that order becomes an official public judgment. It is recorded on the entity's permanent legal record as an active, unsatisfied debt.
It's like someone putting a boot on your car over a parking ticket.
Mm-hmm.
You're standing there with the cash, actively trying to pay the city, but the city refuses to take your money.
Meaning the boot stays on your car indefinitely and you can't drive. That is a perfect analogy.
Wow.
For a corporate entity, having an active, unsatisfied judgment on their public record is a massive liability. When title companies run background checks during real estate transactions, that judgment appears as a red flag.
It can trigger audits from insurance providers. It impacts the corporation's creditworthiness.
Exactly. It is a legal stain that must be removed. And the only way to remove it is to file a formal satisfaction of judgment with the court, which requires proof that the person owed the money actually received it.
If the person refuses to accept the money, the corporation is trapped in legal limbo.
Anita Bell isn't just ignoring a check. She is intentionally holding the corporation's legal record hostage over $237.
And the HOA can't just throw their hands up and tell the judge, hey, we tried, she won't take it. The court order still stands.
The corporation is legally obligated to satisfy the debt. So to clear their record, the Terra Vita Country Club is forced to hire their law firm, billing by the hour, to draft and file a brand new, completely separate lawsuit against Anita Bell.
Just to pay her.
Yes. This specific type of action is called a judgment satisfaction matter. The entire purpose of this new lawsuit is to beg a judge for permission to legally deposit the $237 directly with the clerk of the court.
Oh, my God.
The goal is to have the court hold the money in trust so the HOA can finally receive a piece of paper declaring the judgment satisfied.
They are spending thousands of dollars in attorney's fees to file a lawsuit just to force someone to let them pay a $237 fee. It is the ultimate weaponization of procedure.
And you can read the desperation in the legal phrasing of the demand letters. The primary documents include the actual letters that Joshua Bolin and Anjali Patel sent to Anita Bell before they filed this absurd secondary lawsuit.
What do they say?
On April 19th, 2017, they write, "The Country Club paid the judgment in full, and the judgment has been satisfied. We ask that you send this law firm a copy of the recorded release. If you do not, we will seek all legal recourse."
Trying to sound tough.
Right. But then 3 months later, on July 18th, they try again. "This is our final demand. We appreciate your anticipated cooperation. However, we truly hope that such additional action will not be necessary."
They're practically pleading with her to just take her victory so they can close the book on this tiny issue.
And she simply ignores them, which forces the massive expenditure of legal resources.
And when Brown tries to drag this $237 lawsuit into his own case regarding the record's request, the HOA's lawyers fiercely object.
They tell Judge Hannah, "These cases have absolutely nothing to do with each other. One is a complex argument over statutory records and contempt, and the other is a purely mechanical issue of a judgment creditor refusing payment. Do not let the plaintiff muddy the waters by combining them."
The level of tactical sophistication mixed with sheer interpersonal pettiness is astounding.
It really demonstrates how individuals can find leverage points within the legal system to inflict maximum administrative pain on an opponent, regardless of the actual financial stakes.
When you look at the strategy of suing the spouses, suing the lawyers, and refusing tiny settlement checks just to create new lawsuits, you have to wonder, is this just one uniquely adversarial homeowner clashing with the board, or is this the standard operating procedure for this particular community?
The primary sources answer that question with terrifying clarity.
Attached to one of Mr. Brown's own filings is an exhibit that completely reframes this entire deep dive. It is a document titled Terra Vita Litigation, 72 lawsuits through September 21st, 2017. Let me provide the context for this document. The Terra Vita community was incorporated around 1998. It operates through three main corporate entities: the Country Club, the Community Association, and the Golf Club.
Right.
This exhibit is a multi-page, single-spaced index of every single lawsuit involving these entities since their creation.
72 lawsuits for a single residential community. And these are not just minor infractions handled in a local magistrate's office.
No, the list spans multiple jurisdictions.
There are cases in small claims court, justice court, the Maricopa County Superior Court, all the way up to complex appellate decisions handed down by the Arizona Court of Appeals.
It lists the expected cases where the HOA sues a homeowner for a rules violation, but it also lists defamation suits between neighbors, multiple fights over access to corporate books, battles over legal injunctions.
It paints a picture of a community in a permanent, churning state of legal warfare.
In his filings, Mr. Brown actually uses this staggering history of litigation to build a narrative. He asserts to the judge that there is palpable tension, presumably meaning palpable tension, precipitated by the board of directors and their legal counsel's willful denial of legal rights to its 1380 members.
He is not framing himself as a rogue litigant causing trouble.
No.
He is framing himself as a necessary crusader, utilizing the courts to fight a corrupt corporate regime on behalf of his silenced neighbors.
And he backs up that crusader identity by officially boasting about his win-loss record to the judge. He writes in his motion that in the contested administrative matters and lawsuits, he has been the prevailing party in 11 of 13 adjudicated matters.
11 wins, 2 losses.
He also points out that he and Anita Bell represent themselves pro se 82% of the time.
Achieving an 11-2 record as a pro se litigant against a corporate entity represented by specialized legal counsel is practically unheard of.
It's wild.
It requires a mastery of procedure, an endless amount of free time to dedicate to research and drafting, and an incredibly high threshold for conflict.
Which raises the central sociological question of this deep dive. When a community of 1380 homes is this hyper-litigious, the actual disputes don't even matter anymore, do they?
Not really.
It's not about the records or the rules. It's simply a question of who blinks first. Imagine living in a neighborhood where the primary method of communication between the leadership and the residents isn't a friendly town hall meeting or a monthly newsletter.
It's formal court filings, demand letters, and process servers arriving at your door.
It sounds less like a planned residential community and more like a gladiatorial arena with manicured lawns.
The psychological and financial toll of that environment is incalculable. Every interaction is viewed through the lens of potential liability. Every email is drafted as if it will be read by a judge.
Yeah.
The community's resources, the assessment fees paid by the residents, are continuously drained to fund an unending cycle of motions, countermotions, depositions, and evidentiary hearings. The legal warfare becomes the defining characteristic of the neighborhood.
And you can see the exhaustion of this warfare reflected in how the judicial system itself processes the case. This specific lawsuit did not stay in one place.
The minute entries track its movement across the courthouse.
Right. It was initially assigned to Judge Amy Anderson, but Brown utilized a procedural mechanism, a notice of change of judge, to force it to be reassigned.
The case was transferred to the civil presiding judge, Randall Warner.
And finally, it was reassigned a third time, landing on the desk of Honorable John R. Hanna Jr.
While judicial reassignments are a normal part of court administration, when you combine a bouncing docket with motions to transfer unrelated cases, demands for six-figure sanctions, and exhibits listing 72 prior lawsuits, it creates an incredibly heavy burden on the court.
The judicial system is forced to expend massive resources sifting through layers of interpersonal animosity and procedural maneuvering.
Just to identify the actual underlying legal issue that requires a ruling.
Which finally brings us to the climax of this legal labyrinth. On June 4th, 2018, Judge John R. Hanna Jr. issues a minute entry.
He has reviewed the massive stack of supplemental filings. He has evaluated the demands for $110,000 in sanctions, the motions to dismiss the lawyers, the email chains regarding extensions, and the complex arguments over statutory authority.
And he delivers a ruling that carefully threads the needle between these two warring factions.
It is a brilliantly calculated judicial decision. Let's look at how the judge addresses the core issue, Brown's application for an order to show cause, which was his demand to hold the HOA in contempt for defying the Department of Real Estate's order to hand over the records.
So what does the judge actually decide on the merits?
Judge Hanna reviews the timeline and the evidentiary records produced by both sides. He finds that the defendant, the Terravita Country Club, had eventually complied with the administrative law judge's order.
Oh, so they finally handed over the documents.
Yes. The judge notes in his ruling that the HOA produced the required documents on October 27, 2017.
Okay, let's look back at the chronology.
Nah.
October 27 was right around the time of the initial status conference in this very Superior Court lawsuit.
Exactly. The judge determines that because the documents have now been physically produced, the underlying issue is resolved.
There is no longer a legal basis to hold the HOA in ongoing contempt because there is nothing left to coerce them into doing.
The judge essentially says, "You got your papers, Mr. Brown. The show is over."
Right.
The judge writes that even if Brown could prove the HOA acted in bad faith in the past by delaying the release, Brown had not provided any evidence that the HOA was currently hiding additional information.
Therefore, the judge officially orders the dismissal of Brown's application for an order to show cause with prejudice. With prejudice is a crucial legal term. If I understand the mechanism correctly, it means the court is utilizing the doctrine of claim preclusion.
That's right.
The issue is permanently dead. Brown cannot fix a typo and refile the same complaint tomorrow. The court is protecting itself from a zombie lawsuit.
That is exactly the mechanism. The judge is firmly closing the door on this specific grievance.
So, what does this all mean? The Terravita Country Club got the case dismissed. They won. And the standard assumption in civil litigation is that the winner takes all.
Usually, yes.
When you win a civil lawsuit, especially when you have been dragged into court by a pro se litigant demanding $110,000 in personal sanctions and forcing your outside counsel to defend themselves, you ask the judge to invoke a fee-shifting statute and make the loser pay your massive legal bills.
And that is exactly the maneuver the HOA's lawyers attempt. They file a request asking the court to award them their attorney's fees and costs incurred in defending the action.
They are relying on Arizona's fee-shifting statutes. Right, which are designed to allow a prevailing party in certain types of contract or statutory disputes to recover their expenses.
This is where Judge Hanna delivers the twist that completely redefines the outcome of this case.
It's like a fire department charging you for the water they used to put out your house fire, because they realized upon inspection that you were the one playing with matches in the living room.
That analogy perfectly captures the spirit of the ruling. The judge relies on the legal definition of a prevailing party.
Okay, what does he write?
He writes, "Because the defendant arguably did not produce some of the responsive documents until after the plaintiff had filed suit, the court finds that the defendant is not the prevailing party for purposes of ARS sections 12341 and 12341.01.
Wow.
Even if it was, the court, in its discretion, would not award attorney's fees. The judge officially and permanently denies the defendant's request to have their legal bills covered."
So if I'm understanding the mechanism of this ruling, the judge is looking at the chronological reality of the dispute. Yes, the HOA ultimately secured a dismissal because they handed over the documents.
But they didn't hand them over until October 27.
Right. That was months after the Department of Real Estate issued a final legally binding order telling them to do it. And most importantly, it was weeks after Mr. Brown was forced to file this massive, aggressive Superior Court lawsuit just to get their attention.
This raises an important question. The court recognizes the causality. The judge is essentially telling the HOA, you only complied because he sued you. You do not get financially rewarded for finally doing what the state ordered you to do months ago.
Because the fee-shifting statute in Arizona is not a mandatory loser pays system like the English rule of law. It is discretionary.
Yes. The judge has the authority to look at the totality of the circumstances and the behavior of the parties.
So the judge is ensuring that neither side walks away with a victory parade. It's the legal equivalent of sending both parties to their rooms without supper.
Exactly. The Terravita Country Club successfully avoids the catastrophic $110,000 contempt sanction, and the board members' spouses are safe.
But the corporation has to eat the massive, completely avoidable cost of their own law firm's billable hours for fighting a battle they could have prevented simply by handing over the ledger on day one.
And Mr. Brown finally gets his documents, but his lawsuit is dismissed with prejudice, and he gets absolutely zero financial satisfaction from the board or the attorneys he tried to sanction.
It is a brilliantly balanced resolution to a deeply unbalanced community dynamic. The court used its discretionary power to penalize the friction caused by both sides.
Yeah, they did.
Well, this journey through the primary sources has been incredibly revealing. Let's synthesize the mechanics of what we've unpacked today.
Sounds good.
What began on a summer day in July 2016 as a straightforward statutory request to examine an HOA's financial books mutated into a sprawling 2-year legal saga.
We decoded the administrative limitations of the Department of Real Estate.
We analyzed the devastating leverage of suing spouses in a community property state. We examined the severe legal theory behind attempting to sue opposing counsel.
We saw the day-to-day weaponization of procedural deadlines over email.
We explore the absolute absurdity of a multi-million dollar corporation forced to file a lawsuit just to deposit an uncashed $237 check.
And we looked at the sociology of a community weighed down by a history of 72 different lawsuits.
Ultimately, it culminated in a judicial ruling that dismissed the case, but explicitly punished the HOA's tactical delays by forcing them to swallow their own exorbitant legal costs.
And this deep dive perfectly illustrates a fundamental truth about the nature of civil litigation. The gears of the judicial system grind exceedingly fine, but they grind exceedingly slow.
Yeah.
When you engage in this level of procedural warfare, you have to understand that victory is rarely a cinematic moment of triumph or a massive financial windfall.
In the legal labyrinth of an HOA dispute, victory is often simply the exhaustion of the other side.
It is a war of attrition, measured in filings, objections, and minute entries, where the only true winners are the attorneys billing by the hour.
It really forces a complete reevaluation of what it means to live in a governed community, which leaves us with a final thought to ponder as we close out this deep dive.
What's the thought?
When a community's governing documents are enforced, not through neighborly conversations, but through continuous combative litigation, does winning a lawsuit actually mean you've lost your community?
That's a great question.
Next time you see a notice for your local HOA meeting, ask yourself, what's really hiding in the meeting minutes?
Because as we have seen in the filings today, getting to see those minutes might cost you years of your life.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.